This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning and welcome back to New Books in Eastern European Studies. My name is Piotr Kruszycki. I'm a history professor at the University of Maryland in College Park. I am very pleased to welcome a very special guest to our podcast today. We are welcoming Dr. Piotr Cywiński, the director of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum. He is here to discuss with us his newly translated book, Auschwitz, A Monograph on the Human, which appeared in 2022 with the press of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum. Welcome, Dr. Cywiński.
Good morning. Good morning, everybody.
So Dr. Cywiński has served as director of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum for the past 17 years, since 2006. A trained medievalist, he is an actively engaged leader in Polish-Jewish and Christian-Jewish ecumenical dialogue. He co-founded and serves as chairman of the Auschwitz-Birkenau Foundation, as well as the board of the Auschwitz-Birkenau Institute. Piotr Cywiński is chief expert of the Center for Research on the Economics of Memorial Sites at the SWPS University of Social Sciences and Humanities in Warsaw, as well as co-founder and chairman of the Society for Management of Memorial Sites. From 2017 to 2021, he was chairman of the program board of the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw. He is also a member of other boards and councils of various European institutions, organizations, and memorials. Dr. Cywiński is the author of numerous historical publications, mainly focused on the Middle Ages and on issues connected with the Shoah and its memorialization. His latest, very important volume is the subject of our discussion today. So if you'll permit me to begin maybe with a couple of questions about yourself and how you came to the museum. As you mentioned in the preface to your book, you're a medievalist by training. Your background, I know, is in ecumenical dialogue, and you have a long record of leadership roles in Poland's Catholic Intelligentsia Clubs movement, something I've researched in my own scientific work. I am curious, and I'm sure our readers are too, how did it happen that you became director of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum?
It was a long story, to be honest. In 2000, I think, Professor Władysław Bartoszewski, who was reappointed as a chief of the International Auschwitz Council, asked me if I would accept to be member of this council, just to be the secretary general of this council, because he said, yes, you know, in this council, we are mainly survivors, we are becoming more and more older. We need somebody young to help us a little bit. It's not a big deal, you know, it's not a job, it's a service. Two meetings per year, it's not too much. Okay. You know, Bartoszewski was an enormous authority in Poland, especially on those issues of the history of the 20th century of Auschwitz or Second World War. And of course, I accepted proudly to help him. And I was secretary of this council, a council, yes, 25 people around the world, from the US, from Great Britain, from France, from Israel, from Poland, from Russia, from really different countries. That was, let's say, the highest authority in order to make some very sometimes difficult choices about the how to preserve Auschwitz, how to teach Auschwitz, how to deal with this history. There were really some excellent survivors, professors of history themselves, from Yad Vashem, from people from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. So I served during 6 years. And after those 6 years, my predecessor in the museum was preparing his retreat, and they asked me to continue as a director of the museum. It was for me a very difficult choice because, yes, I was a medievalist historian. I just finished my PhD. I wanted really to work more on those 10, 11th century, really old times. I felt very comfortable in that period. But at least, you know, you cannot refuse such an ask coming from a group of eminent survivors. The most, let's say, well-known authorities on the topic of the Shoah or concentration camps, you can't say no, and what to do after, you know. So I accepted. It was for me a complete change because, of course, I did not have any more time to working on my early Middle Ages. But very, very quickly, I understood that it was perhaps one of the most important decisions in my life and one of the most difficult responsibility that one can imagine. Because it's not only the site, it's not only the preservation of the site, it's not only, let's say, the organization of the visit, but it's also the clear voice of this history, the clear message going completely to the entire world that you have to manage. And of course, at the beginning, there were still a lot of survivors who were able to help me to understand the past, to understand their story, their remembrance, their, let's say, anxiety about the today's time. But with the years, this group becomes more and more small, of course, because they are very, very old people. And of course, I felt that the role that is on my position becomes more and more crucial, especially in the world that is changing so quickly. So many different other tragedies or politics of dehumanizations appears in so many different places, like at least today in Ukraine, attacked by Russia, but in so many other places. So of course, this voice of Auschwitz becomes a crucial issue for the present and the future. This was really briefly said the story of my work in Auschwitz in the last 17 years.
Well, I was going to say 17 years is an enormous amount of time to be at the helm of any institution. But of course, Auschwitz is possibly certainly one of the most visible memorial sites in the world, certainly the most visible Holocaust memorial site in the world. I realize also it's not just the museum, it's not just the crafting of the experience of the encounter with those who visit, but also research and a publishing institution. And you mentioned of course, having a lot less time or no time to work on your interest as a medievalist, but you've published a great deal, both in terms of your own analysis and collections of testimonies over the years from Auschwitz survivors. I'm curious if you can talk for a minute, and this is by way of now transitioning into the book that is our focus today, how you personally have chosen which projects to take on and which really needed to be published. Also, which ones needed to be published in English versus being published in Polish by the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum?
We have a group of historians or scientific people in the museum, 8 or 10, it depends of the years, and they have their own chief, the chief of the Center of Studies. So there's nothing more, let's say, awful than a director, let's say, manager who enter with his ideas to a historical center, let's say, to a group of historians and to tell them what they have to do or what they do not have to do. So I really try not to influence them, not to enter in their programs or their evolution of the studies. But as far as I am not only a manager now, but a historian at the BIDIS, I started my own, let's say, researches based on the archives of Auschwitz, based on the all the books written by the survivors, written of diverse documents, plans, and all what is disponible in, around the world. But of course, it was not my job as a director of the museum. It was something that they did mainly and very late in the evening or during nights after my work, because I was thinking that I have something to tell to the new generations. First of all, in this subject of voices of survivors, I wrote 5 small books relating different aspects of the Auschwitz history, like the arrival to the Rampa of the Jewish transport, like the beginning of the camp with some Polish transport from the prison of Tarnów, like the story of the Sonderkommando, those prisoners who were obliged to work close to the gas chambers and the crematoria. So yes, it was my first approach when I was trying to collect as many memoirs of survivors in order to give them the voice and to let them present some parts of the story. It took me, I don't know, 2 or 3 years to publish in Polish until now only those 5 small books. And when I was thinking if I have to continue this series or if I have to change something or if I have something else to say, I was arriving to the conclusion that finally we are speaking since decades about facts, about dates, about numbers, about really a historiography, very very precise, very, very, let's say, like in the books of history in the colleges, you know, you have only facts and numbers or percentages or I don't know what. But in fact, when you read it, and I read a lot of books of survivors or even things that were never published, you arrive to the conclusion that from one side, yes, it's normal that historians after the war, especially in the last, 4 decades maybe, were terrifically working really in a very hard way on the facts, because it's a story that was attacked, that was denied, that was, changed so many times by some crazy people that we must be sure about some fundamental historical truth. But at least the survivors told us about some completely also different things that were their own experience, their human conditions, They were trying to explain how they survived, what was their force, what was their fear, all this interior of the human beings that you know didn't finish with the liberation, because until the end of their life, they were dreaming about that. They were they've got some traumatical reactions nearly every day on those bases. It was an experience that was with them until the end of their life, and we didn't really analyze this in a large perspective because we were so focused. Every historian of Auschwitz about the facts, the numbers, and the concrete dates. So this human perspective was a little bit, let's say, apart of it was a bit far of our focus of history, and that's why I was coming back to all those testimonies, and I was trying to read them one more time and to find those. Words, those quotes, those small fragments that were learning us about what Auschwitz was in their own experience. What was the loneliness in the camp? What was the hunger? What was the cold? What was the lack of hygiene? What was the, I don't know, the willpower, the friendship, the empathy, the love, maybe, the fear, you know, all those feelings that are, let's say, an essence, if you want really to understand what Auschwitz was. After, yes, some 5 years, maybe, of research, I arrived to a moment that these collections of quotations was, I don't know, more than 1,700 quotations, quotes of survivors. I was arriving to a moment that I said to myself, yes, I have to try to explain that to a larger public, because, of course, in my approach, it was something very, very linked to what those survivors from the International Auschwitz Council or some other survivors that were coming back to Auschwitz for, I don't know, conferences or educational purposes, was telling me many, many times. And they presented me this way of thinking, this way of approaching the history of Auschwitz, not through facts, but through emotions and through individual experience. And this was how this last book, this one more monographic, but completely different from all the other monographies on Auschwitz or on the Holocaust, the Shoah, was prepared.
Thank you very much. The reader, any reader of this book will immediately discover it's a big book. It's a book of synthesis, but also it's a book that so heavily draws on so many different primary source testimonies. I mean, you mentioned the number of quotations. It's extraordinary. I wanted to maybe ask a few different questions, but I'll start with this one in particular. I was reading your preface, and of course, it's hard not to have that line from Adorno in one's head about there being no poetry after Auschwitz, but there was testimony. And so I grew up in the United States. I had to read parts of Primo Levi actually in high school. So in that sense, I had already when I was quite young in my mind some of these testimony writings. However, there seems like a paradox here, and I was wondering if you could reflect, please, for a moment for our listeners' benefit. On the one hand, you mentioned that for getting at the human experience of Auschwitz, there are no other sources than the former prisoner memoirs, accounts, and stories. You actually say, I'm quoting, "It is only there that a historian can seek information," in your preface. At the end, though, of the book, in the conclusions, you say, I'm quoting again, we also must remember that they only told us about that which they wanted to tell, that which they were capable of telling, and what, according to them, we should understand. That's the end of the quote. And I think that that makes perfect sense, of course. It's a very elegant way of bringing the book to a close. I'm curious if these two are in contradiction, not because of anything you've done, but because of the nature of the sources and how you as the historian and your readers as students of history should experience or process that contradiction.
I'm not sure the term of contradiction is maybe not too brutal. It is how I experience, let's say, those sources. Of course, there are the only sources that we have. But if I refer to my medieval researchers, we never have enough sources for the 10th or the 11th century. We are every time in a deep lack of sources. Here we have certainly more sources than for the 11th century, for example. But we have to, without entering in some psychological approaches, I am not a psychologist, I didn't want to do something, but it's very clear for me, if I analyze those sources in a critical approach, that not everything was certainly told. There are themes that are less present for different reasons, certainly. For example, the shock was too big, or the trauma was too big. A few prisoners are speaking about the kids in the camp, for example. And for me, it's very, very clear that this is something that was so traumatical for them that they didn't find, let's say, the good words to speak, to report what's happened. But also some others certainly tema do not appear many times. I think that in another hand, the majority of the survivors, when they prepared their memoirs, they were deeply analyzing in their mind what we, the post-war generations, that was not going through this experience, what we will be able to understand. Because, first of all, the reality of the camp is something completely different from our world. And from the other hand, even our words, our expressions, they are coming from a free world, from a natural world, and they are not every time, let's say, there are not some perfect designations to speak about Auschwitz. And this is methodologically very difficult, certainly, if you have to speak about a world completely different using our normal words. When you speak about the fear or about hunger, it's something completely different than we can imagine when we use our 2 days, language, those notions. Because it was something not pushed at the extremity of those notions. It was something catapulted far, 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 far after the borders, let's say, of what we understand when we are speaking about those notions. So, for those different reasons, after all those lectures and after all those discussions with survivors also, I'm quite sure that they were speaking only about things that they were thinking that we will be able to understand.
Thank you very much. You mentioned already that the historiography has traditionally focused a great deal on defining the fact pattern for obvious reasons, because of the long history of denialism and revisionism and the need to establish the foundations. That being said, as a reader, I felt like you maybe because the book is in translation, but I want as many readers as possible to read it in translation. So I will ask this question. Did you make a choice to draw less maybe than you might have on the English language historiography? It didn't necessarily seem relevant given the argument you are often making about experience, but since I am always thinking about how I'm going to teach a book, and I was thinking about the same thing when I was reading your book, I did note the fact that really for me, this is almost a subject for a workshop and how to seek out different primary sources in different venues. But almost all of the scholarship that you reference is in Polish, and almost all of it is from several decades ago. And I'm just curious if you feel like that was almost, you know, like Przegląd Lekarski or Zeszyty Oświęcimskie. They are in their own way a kind of set of primary sources. So I was curious if that's why you use them and you didn't want to get into the big historiography, or if there was a different choice there.
You know, 90% of my books that I quote in these books are survivors' books, and of course my language limitations was certainly one of the more critical aspects of this work, but this is something that every scholar that are working on the Holocaust, you know, I was able to read in English, in Polish, in French, more or less in German or in Italian or in Czech, but certainly not in Hungarian or in Yiddish. So this is already something very, very difficult. But as you mentioned, this review that was published in Krakow during some 30 years, the Przegląd Lekarski, was the only one publication in the world when many different aspects of the life in the camp and many different aspects of what that means being survivors was analyzed by diverse doctors, psychologists, or historians. It was really the only one. It was nominated 2 times for the Nobel Prize. This publications of something like 30 volumes. That's why I used it a lot. But we have to think that we have to remember that, you know, in the early times after the war, there were some first memoirs of prisoners that was published, and some research of the Kacet syndrome. So the, let's say, psychological and not only psychological, but health influence of the camp on the survivors. This was done particularly in Germany because there were some programs of help to the survivors after the war. But in fact, during long decades, it was a history operated on facts and not on emotions or human interior. And the majority of the memoirs of survivors were published at the end of their life, in the 90s, in the 2000s. Many of them were not translated until now in many other languages. The first one, yes, Primo Levi, of course, Elie Wiesel, many others, yes, because they were the first in the 50s, in the, some of them even at the end of the 40s. But those who were published in the last, let's say, 25 years were not translated so much because at that time there were already many of them published in different languages. So This is also something that influenced this book, but I think that this reality influenced every book on Auschwitz or on the Holocaust, because the diversity of languages is absolutely enormous. You have sources published in, I don't know, 12 or 15 languages at least. Some languages that were even not linked to some concrete countries, like the Ladino for the Jews from Greece or the Balkans. It's very, very difficult to prepare a book that would present, let's say, conclusions from all around the world, because strictly no one historian of the Holocaust is able to speak in 12 or 15 languages.
Thank you. I should ask, I mean, obviously, the language that is most familiar to you, I would assume you would agree, is Polish. And this is, I think, an interesting question that you raise. I like that you raised it already in the preface. And I'm curious how you felt your own position on this question changed while you were writing the book. In the preface, you mentioned that during the communist times, because, of course, the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum was in communist Poland, most of the testimonies that were produced were Polish non-Jewish testimonies. And I'm curious how you feel now, having gone through, you put it, tens or hundreds of thousands of pages, what is the role and what is the proper proportion for Polish language testimony in the overall field of testimony? And this is even before we get into questions about the Holocaust and the non-Jewish experience, but just Polish language, where does it belong?
You know, I can speak only about Auschwitz. I didn't analyze this in the history of the ghettos or some other camps, of course. But in Auschwitz, some 405,000 people were entered into the camp. That means they were not murdered directly after the arrival, but they were they received a number. They were prisoners. 405,000. Half of them were Jews. 150,000 were Poles. Some smaller groups were so-called Gypsy, Roma, and Sinti, or Soviet prisoners of war. So I think that today, when we analyze those testimonies that are coming from the survivors of Auschwitz, it represents those proportions, more or less. But of course, some of those testimonies were not given in Auschwitz, in our museum, but were given in some other institutions. So I've got to work at that time with, for example, with the great help of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, or some friends, specialists in this history from France, or I've got to search by myself some publications that were published in different countries, even sometimes in those countries when that was not participating in the Second World War, like Switzerland, but they received some survivors after the war, and that published some, I don't know, 20 or 30 very interesting testimonies of those people after the war. So now the main question is not the proportion, it's not the numbers, it's not the main question is that it is, there are some very important archives or collections in a few institutions, like Washington, like Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, like Poland, like France, but like Bad Arolsen, for example, in Germany. But also some publications that were published, but only in those countries, sometimes in a very small small number of books. You know, I've got some editions of memoirs. It was published, I don't know, 50 exemplars, for example, mainly for the approach, or one or two exemplars sent to some universities. It was sometimes quite difficult to find them.
So I will then ask also about how the testimonies that you read have made you think, now that you've written the book, published the book, about the difference between Jewish experience and other experiences. I don't want to generalize. I like the fact that in the book you draw distinctions, but also collect testimonies. On the other hand, you do make some distinctions. For example, especially in the initial phase, you talk about the impact those who on that ramp saw their loved ones for the very last time, right? And the gas chambers are ever present in the testimonies. So what would, if you could offer some generalizations for our listeners' benefit, the Jewish experience of the prisoners versus non-Jewish experience. In other words, how much of your book contributes to the Holocaust scholarship versus how much is specifically Auschwitz?
I really wanted to speak about Auschwitz, but Auschwitz has two periods. It is 1940 to 1942. It's a regular concentration camp, mainly for Poles. But among them, you have also some first Jews who appears because they were part of the intelligentsia, the part of the elites of the country. They were sent for different reasons to the camp. And from 42 until nearly the end of 44 at least, this becomes also a center of extermination. And from that time, it was, of course, a different story that plays in the same place. But the two stories have their own survivors. And the two stories, for some, let's say, approaches, can be compared and can be analyzed, let's say, together. Of course, it was a completely different story for different reasons. As you mentioned, the arrival with entire families. If you think about some very orthodox families, it could be 20 people. It could be really some important big families. When after 2 hours, only one or two of them survived in the camp, because all the others from the rampa were conducted to the gas chambers. This is something completely different, and emotionally, of course, it plays an enormous role. But there was also some other, I think, aspect that was very, very important in this, let's say, differentiation between the two groups. For the Christians in the camp, it was perhaps more easy to refer to their faith, to their religion, because in the Christianity you have this very important symbol of a God who died himself in a cruel way in order to save the humanity. Okay, of course, I don't want to enter in any comparison. I'm not a theologian, but let's say this perspective of a very, very, very important, I think, perspective of a cruel end that can have a sense is something completely different of the Jewish experience. In the Jewish religion, the basic, let's say, idea of the Jewish religion is a pact between the God and the chosen nation. And this pact said, you will be my nation and I will be your God. I will protect you, I will save you. You remember the going through the Red Sea and all this history. Let's say it's a completely different approach. Because at that moment, the pact didn't function. And for many of them, it was a moment of They didn't know really at that time. Even great rabbis or religious authorities didn't have enough answer to that when they were thinking among them what's going on. What is the sense of the religion? Is a fundamental pact do not work? So this also was I think some important differences between those two worlds. Of course, I'm not speaking about the comportment of the Nazi, the SS of the who for sure treated the Jews in a certainly more critical and bad way than the Christians.
Yeah, no, of course. And in the book, you draw many such, I think, important distinctions. The question of religion is profoundly, obviously confusing in the sense that it introduces a kind of structural differentiation, but at the same time, it really helps to get at this question of experience. Like you said, without getting into high theology, I found your chapter on faith and religiosity to be very, very illuminating. And that point about choosing to talk about faith as a way of seeing one distinction between different groups. You chose many topics to discuss in this book. For those who haven't read it yet, it's not chronological. I don't think it could be chronological given the nature of the testimony. It is about, arranged by topics. So you yourself already have mentioned a few: sex, faith, resistance, empathy, decency. If I can ask in general terms, how did you pick the topics? I know you talk very, I think, importantly at the beginning of your chapter on death, and you say, well, initially I thought death would be at the end, and then I realized that makes no sense. It's not accurate. But how did you pick the other topics?
It was a long story also. At the beginning, when I was collecting the quotations of the testimonies, I prepared some 30 or 35 different, let's say, bags when I put those quotations, those quotes. But sometimes I realized when this bag was coming more and more full of quote that it was my projections, my vision, it was based on my experience and not really on what they told us. So sometimes I have to divide those collections, those bags into two other bags, or I've got to put two together. It was a quite long evolution because really what I wanted, I think my biggest fear was that it could not be a book that I will be the director of the structure or of this message. I really wanted to give the floor to the survivors. So many times I've got to rethink, let's say, the structure in order to be more accurate to what they say to us.
Oh, I understand. The structure, though, also for me. So I'm a professor. I teach courses where I will directly use, probably not the whole book given its length, but parts of the book I will use for sure. And I was just making notes to myself. You know, obviously in the past I've used parts of Primo Levi or Elie Wiesel or Viktor Frankl, and these books make impressions on students. I think that your book will too. I'm curious if you have any maybe advice or counsel is one way of thinking about it, but how you thought about students coming to the book. Holocaust education obviously is a huge priority internationally and very importantly so. It's not the same as genocide prevention, but the two conversations are linked. So this book, your book, I think could be taught in Holocaust courses. But of course, the Holocaust is an overlapping part of other stories, World War II, Nazi Germany, resistance. Do you have a sense of where the book fits best, maybe, for students? Or I know that this is just a recommendation, but I'm curious what you think as a teaching tool.
You know, when I was starting to work on these books, I wanted to achieve two goals. First of all, that it will be certainly a historical, scientific book. I wanted that it will be written in a way that could interest a large public also. There are so many historical books that are absolutely impossible to be written, to be read by a large public, because they are interesting only the specialists of this topic. Now here I really wanted to create something something larger, let's say, from that perspective. And you know, I was already, since the Polish version was published 1 year before the English version, I was already invited to some discussions about the experience of the prisoners of the Soviet Gulag system of the camps from the perspective of this book, of course. If I see some differences or not, I was already discussing some ideas of these books with some people from Rwanda who wanted also to see something more. So I think, you know, here I described Auschwitz, but at least now, in the 2 days' time, Auschwitz becomes a symbol worldwide, representing not only Auschwitz, but also the entire Holocaust. Even if the Holocaust didn't start in the gas chambers, this was the last element. But it's also a symbol very, very important for many other genocides or politics of dehumanizations. I am in contact with many different institutions in the world, I don't know, Cambodia or many, many others, and Armenia. And of course, I see that this, let's say, reference point that is Auschwitz is very, very important to them. Also to think about the differences, about the, you know. So I think it was very important to present Auschwitz as it was at the level of the human experience, because it will perhaps help the others to find some, I don't know, some specific differences in some other history, and perhaps to also to try to work more with the testimonies and with the quotes of survivors, because it's extremely important. You can't really present this history of human being in those extreme conditions without those quotes, without those testimonies, and I think there is still some countries that it's quite possible to have some very large testimonies, like Rwanda, for example. Some others, like Armenia, who certainly it's too late to find some new sources, but there are still some tragedies in the world, and I think there are things that could be analyzed in the similar way in order to find some perhaps at the end some regularities, something that you can really compare, not only to compare, because comparison in such a disasters are sometimes painful, but in order to understand the mechanisms. Think about the war now in Ukraine. This war will be a completely different war than all the others war, only because every soldier and every victim has a mobile phone. So he recalled hundreds or thousands of pictures, and at the meta version, you have the localizations, the exact time, you have every information. If you think about the Second World War or some other wars, like, I don't know, Vietnam or different other conflicts, you'd never had a so important potential source of information, of visual information, taking at the exact time of the war. So, of course, this, between different conflicts or between different genocides, the sources are changing. But we are speaking about the victims. But you are speaking about what they feel at the terrific time, what they remember after, what was their emotions. I think, yes, the sources can change, but the story of the humanity remained.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I had wanted to ask you about other parts of the world, and it's clear that obviously Auschwitz is the cardinal point of reference. I was mindful while you were talking about Ukraine. Of course, one of the great problems with the technology is that we have seen also that the technology can be manipulated. And so I know we'll get into these same debates with denialists and revisionists who will say, ah, the metadata were modified, or something happened and we don't have the same documentation that we need, even though it was digitally recorded. But I'm mindful specifically of a point that you make repeatedly in your conclusions, which is, on the one hand, the words in the experiences of survivors mean something different because it was a different world, right? So I was very struck when you mentioned in the book, about 100 pages in, that very rarely do survivors use the word murder. That's a very striking thing, given the overall observation. And I wonder if, I mean, obviously this is a prediction, but when you talk to representatives from the Rohingya, from Rwanda, from what you think about the experience of the Uyghurs in China, those who are experiencing large-scale atrocity, are you worried about this vocabulary and its manipulation?
No. As the experience of the historical research on the Holocaust prove it, the manipulations at the end are in a smaller number than the good historians. And at the end, the historical truth, I think, will win. But of course, because in general, genocide appears in some non-democratical regimes, when there are some entire institutions devoted to propaganda, to populism, to a way to rewrite the history. Of course, there are many difficulties. And that's why I think there's nothing more important than to collect and to work on the real sources. At the end, it is not a fiction of our imaginations that will stay, but the real words of the survivors, of the victims, even if they, as we told before, even if they told us only what they were thinking, that we will be able to understand.
Are you worried about the future of Holocaust memory in general in Europe today?
Worried? Perhaps not, because I am quite an optimist in general. But I am a little bit worried about the way that more and more politicians are using history in many countries. When I was a teenager, in the 80s, when on the TV or on some newspapers, I find some positions on the history, some discussions about history, it was mainly historians who were discussing. Now in 80 or 90%, it is politicians and not historians. They are not discussing on biology or geography or oceanography, but on history every time. And I think it's not something that that is very mature and positive, because their role is to do politics and not to present the historical truth. They have to defend an ideology, a position, a vision. Not the goal of the history. History is a very exact science, certainly the more exact science between all the humanities. And the history cannot be used for many other reasons, even if those reasons are noble and good. History is a history. You can't change the past. So this is something that I regret sometimes when I hear how much the historians are used, the politicians are used the history in their approach, in the discourse, in their populistic, way to speak, even in those new, very short messages, like on the tweets or on the Facebook. History is something too complex and too important. It is something that is representing our common experience. You cannot use the experience for some other reasons, because it very shortly it becomes a non-experience, but just a political goal.
No. If I may, just one final question. Do you have another book on which you're working right now?
I just finished a sort of book or album representing, some 200 plants of Auschwitz, designed by the office of the so-called Bauleitung, the office of the construction of the camp, that represent different aspects, entire plans of Auschwitz, but also plans, architectural plans, also barracks or buildings or even gas chambers. So I tried to have a quite huge collections of those plans. I wanted to present, let's say, a choice of them, but a very representative choice with some comments. It is published in Polish and in English. And I was thinking more or less on the teachers that can sort of use those drawings, those plans, or in the schools, because they are very, very sometimes relevant documents created by the SS.
Judging by the book that you've sent me, it's going to be a very important work for teachers to use as well. I did want to say, as a university professor, I hope that this book is widely available for students to access. I know right now the best way to get to Dr. Tsivinsky's book is to go to the website, if I understand correctly,
yes,
of the museum.
Books.auschwitz.org. This is the best way, and I think the most quick to receive it by shipping.
So it remains for me to thank our distinguished guest, Dr. Piotr Tsivinsky, director of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum, for joining us today and sharing the story of his new book, Auschwitz, A Monograph on the Human, published in 2022 by the press of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you to everyone who wanted to hear this story.
Yes, thank you to our listeners as well. Have a good afternoon.